DW, World in Progress. With Sarah Steffen.
Welcome to the show, I'm Sarah Steffen. As the UN Declaration of Human Rights turns 70, we take a look at the state of human rights.
This is a terrible moment, I think, not just for the UN, but really for the world in terms of, you know, human rights and human rights violations.
We also go to Jordan to see how Syrian refugees are faring.
We can't return to Syria because our house has been destroyed. We don't have a home anymore. We're also scared because it's not safe in Syria anymore.
Stay with us for a new episode of DW's World on Progress. This week marks 70 years of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a milestone document enshrining fundamental human rights, from acknowledging that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, to the right to freedom of expression and access to information. Unfortunately, reality often doesn't live up to that. Anna-Sophie Brändlin has this report by Georg Schwarte.
An incident that reflects the mood of an impatient world interrupts proceedings at the United Nations Assembly.
It's November the 18th, 1948, and news channels across the world are reporting something unusual. The UN General Assembly has been holding a meeting for weeks in Paris. They've been fighting, discussing, but on this very day, the situation escalates. A man in the auditorium stands up and starts screaming. I am going to interrupt the meeting. Delegates, I'm interrupting you in the name of world citizens who are not represented. What happens next can only be described as turmoil. The man who interrupted the meeting, Gary Davis, is being led away and arrested. He'd previously given up his American passport and had named himself the first world citizen. And in the midst of the UN General Assembly discussing human rights, his idea had been spread into the world. A world government rather than individual states, world citizenship and equal rights for everyone. Overnight, Gary Davis became famous.
Here's Gary Davis.
World citizen number one, Gary Davis.
Gary Davis.
Gary Davis.
Gary Davis.
Gary Davis.
Gary Davis.
The former U.S. Army soldier who served during the Second World War as a B-17 bomber pilot in the Air Force and was pained not only by his own brother's death on the battlefield, but also by the suffering he caused other families by bombing the German city of Brandenburg in World War II, quickly made headlines with a stunt. More and more people took to the streets to protest in front of the conference doors in Paris. First, it was hundreds, then thousands. Important contemporaries, such as Albert Einstein, Albert Schweitzer, and Albert Camus, supported Gary Davis' idea of introducing global universal rights. The pressure amounted to the point that something unbelievable happened. Eleanor Roosevelt, widow of U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was presiding over the UN Human Rights Commission back then, had been busy writing a declaration together with a Canadian, Lebanese, two French, and a Chinese representative to bring forward 30 universal human rights, which the UN General Assembly were now asked to vote on.
We stand today at the threshold of a great event, both in the life of the United Nations and in the life of mankind. This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
Eleanor Roosevelt had been fighting tirelessly for this declaration, which was 1,300 words long and spanned over 30 articles. But it was Gary Davis, world citizen number one, who gave wings to the battle. On December 10th, 1948, just over 3 weeks after his stunt, the 56 nations eligible to vote in the UN General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Abstain. Soviet Union. Abstain. United Kingdom. Yes.
48 nations voted yes, 8 abstained, including Saudi Arabia, South Africa, which back then was under apartheid, and the Eastern Bloc states of Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. The East-West conflict was born, the Cold War only just beginning. But on that day, humanity managed to do something that no one deemed possible, to come up with a Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
The first article of the Universal Declaration is clear. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights.
That's current UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres reading out Article 1 of the Declaration 70 years after it was born. Back then, the historic moment was summed up like this.
This declaration comes from an entirely different field of the United Nations, which gets very little attention as compared with the political matters which divide us so often. It deals with the social, the humanitarian, the cultural fields of our activities. And although this is only a first step, as speakers have pointed out, it simply declares rights. It doesn't provide by international convention for states being bound to carry out and give effect to those rights, nor does it provide for enforcement. Still, it is the first step in a great evolutionary process.
But as just mentioned by then-president of the UN General Assembly, Herbert Evatt, it's a document that doesn't legally bind any nation, that isn't enforceable. And in the end, it didn't prevent the genocide in Rwanda and still doesn't stop the horrendous suffering in Syria or Yemen. Kofi Annan, who used to be the General Secretary of the United Nations, once put it like this.
Human rights are not to be found in dusty legal libraries, but in the hearts and minds of human beings.
What Eleanor Roosevelt had in mind originally was a human rights pact that's binding under international law. For good reason. Because 70 years after the Declaration of Human Rights, the condition of human rights across the world are rather devastating.
This is a terrible moment, I think, not just for the UN, but really for the world in terms of, you know, human rights and human rights violations.
That's Shireen Tadros, head of Amnesty International in New York. Violence in Myanmar, war in Yemen, poison gas attacks in Syria, the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi Arabia. All of that happened despite the Declaration of Human Rights. Human rights organizations in 190 states the world over are busy recording human rights violations every day. But Amnesty's Tadros says the document itself was still an important stepping stone. It was written against the backdrop of millions of victims of the Second World War. It was the first time the world stood up and said, we deserve human rights because we're humans, not because we were born in a certain place or have a certain skin color.
That should never be forgotten, especially at a moment like this.
The right to live, the right for asylum, the right to work, and the right to have equal pay. All of those are human rights, according to the declaration. The fact that now, 70 years after this universal declaration, world leaders like US President Donald Trump are backpedaling, cancelling multilateral agreements, and questioning universal rules is the real danger, says Amnesty's Tadros.
There has to be a baseline of rules that we don't violate. And this is what is under attack right now. And that's very dangerous.
That report by Georg Schwarte was presented by Anna-Sophie Brändlin. Authoritarian populists are on the rise around the world, from US President Donald Trump to President-elect Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. In Hungary and Poland, populist leaders are destroying the free press and are undermining independent institutions. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan continues his crackdown on opposition forces. Earlier, I spoke to Arch Puddington, distinguished scholar for democracy studies with the US-based NGO Freedom House. I started by asking him what the erosion of democracy means for human rights.
If you live in a country that has strong checks and balances, strong democratic institutions, you have extra protections against an erosion of human rights, even if you have, let's say, a Trump as president. We have courts that push back against Trump. We have a press that pushes back against Trump. We have a civil society that pushes back against Trump. It would require many, many years and rather considerable amount of erosion of democratic institutions for there to be some kind of a significant effect on human rights. But if you don't have that, as in Hungary, for example, or Turkey, if you have a new democracy and a fragile democracy and weak institutions, then the populist leader, the strongman leader, can do all kinds of things to the human rights of people in the country, ranging from what's been done in Russia, destroyed an independent press, somehow or another contributed to the murder of political oppositionists, contributed to the weakening of civil society. Anyone who is involved in partisan politics, who is on the opposition side, who is a dissident, their human rights are going to be immediately at risk under a strongman populist leader in a country that has weak democratic institutions.
What are the telltale signs of a democracy under threat? What are the more obvious and also the more subtle signs?
I see democracy as built around three fundamental institutions: elections, a free press, and the rule of law. And if we look at what can happen to those three institutions, you can see the warning signs right away. Let's look at elections. One of the first signs of an authoritarian takeover of a government is once an Orban has won power, or an Erdogan has won power, or Putin, they start to take measures to protect themselves from losing in subsequent elections. They gerrymander the political districts. They take measures to suppress the opposition, not to destroy it, but just simply to marginalize it. And they take various kinds of technical measures, which all combined make it very, very difficult for the opposition to ever win power again. If you look at a free press, once a strongman leader takes over, one of his first goals always, always is to change the balance of media coverage. One of the first steps you see in every one of these countries is to destroy the independence of the state media, to turn the state media into a propaganda media that supports the government in power. This is what happened in Hungary. This is what happened in Russia, and it's even what happened in Poland. It was actually the first measure that was taken by the PIS government, the Law and Justice government. And then the next step is to pressure opposition media or dissident media or critical media, pressure them by either bringing lawsuits against them, slander suits, to make it economically unfeasible for these outlets to stay in existence. Rule of law, right off the bat, in Poland, after having transformed the state media, the next goal of the Law and Justice government was to tame the judiciary. And they did that through various measures that overhauled the judiciary, that enabled the new government to replace judges en masse with their own political loyalists. This follows a pattern that has already taken place in Hungary, and it's taken place in Russia, Venezuela, and other countries that have come under strongman leadership.
If you repeatedly call independent media fake news, I mean, Trump might be the most prominent leader using it, but it's also caught on elsewhere. How dangerous is it to a democracy to discredit the press, the fourth estate?
It's very dangerous. And again, it depends on the strength of independent institutions to protect press freedom. I mean, the interesting thing about media conditions in the United States is that if you talk to reporters for the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or other media outlets that Trump has targeted as his enemies, they will tell you that actual working conditions are not much worse than they were under Obama or George W. Bush. So as of now, I would say that there's not been any real erosion of press freedom in the United States, but it is a worrying, what you say is certainly true. You don't want to have a president denouncing the press on an almost daily basis, and it is certainly something you have to worry about in countries where you don't have the kinds of First Amendment press freedom protections that you do in the United States. And I think it's something that, for example, in a country like Brazil, you have to worry about that almost immediately after Bolsonaro becomes president.
We'll hear more from Arch Puddington after a short break. When we return, we'll look at the crimes against the Rohingya Muslim minority in Myanmar and how reporters are treated when they're reporting on these atrocities. I would like to talk to you about the case of Myanmar, where two Reuters journalists were jailed over a year ago for reporting on the massacre of the Rohingya Muslim minority. And during the pre-trial hearings, a prosecution witness told the court that police had actually planted military documents in order to frame the reporters for violating the country's Official Secrets Act. What does the case mean for human rights and democracy?
I would say the whole Rohingya, call it genocide if you want, has terrible implications for Myanmar. Just do keep in mind that, let's say, 5 years ago, Myanmar, according to Freedom House, was a country that was moving in the right direction. It was moving away from this military dictatorship towards some kind of civilian rule. And now you have a major retreat from all those gains. So, and let's be clear about it. The military makes the decisions in Myanmar, not the civilian, the elected civilian government. It's the military that makes the decisions. It's the military that's decided to put these two journalists in jail. And that's the Trump effect. I mean, Trump basically has aligned himself with strong men around the world. He's had nice things to say about Sisi of Egypt, Putin, Xi Jinping, Erdogan, Orban, not to mention the Saudi leadership. He embraces all these people as his friends and people he admires. So if you're the military in Myanmar, you don't have to worry about the United States anymore. That's the message that's being sent.
Freedom House has extensively reported on the rise of digital authoritarianism. If we're looking to China's Xinjiang province, where earlier this year a UN human rights panel said it had received many credible reports that a million or more Uyghurs are being held at internment camps, can you give us some insight as to how tech and surveillance are being used to control the Uyghur population?
You can start with truly pervasive security cameras all over Xinjiang. You can look at other kind of surveillance equipment that has been put in people's homes by the state so that they can monitor their lives on a daily basis. You can look at the way that the state is using artificial intelligence to gauge individual citizens, well, I don't know how you call it, their civic behavior. So
you're getting at the social credit score, right?
Yes. Yes. In other words, whether people pay their bills on time, whether they petition the state, whether they protest, whether they send out messages on social media that offend the political leadership, and so on and so forth. And they look at all these different factors and they give people a score, and they can take people away and put them in these re-education camps where they have now, by some estimates, millions of people, millions of Uyghurs and other Muslims. What's especially worrying is that these techniques that are now being developed in China are for export. So I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see the spread of these kinds of Chinese systems beyond China's borders.
That was Arch Puddington from Freedom House speaking to me from New York. Over 1 million Syrian refugees are currently believed to be living in the small kingdom of Jordan. They fled their country's raging war that started 7 years ago. In the past few months, some have returned to Syria. But for many, that's not an option. Anna Almeling visited Syrian refugees in Jordan, and her report is presented by Sam Baker.
Raba is making fresh coffee. It's a luxurious treat for her, as she can barely afford the coffee beans. She shares a small two-bedroom apartment with her four children on the outskirts of Jordan's capital, Amman. Raba gets by with the help of odd jobs here and there and support from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. It's a tough life for the 40-year-old, but she says she can't return to her hometown of Homs either, at least not now.
I worry about my son, that he's forced into military service or that he's being killed in Syria. It's bad enough his father was killed.
Before the war started, Raba and her family lived in their own house, close to her parents and sisters. Raba's husband worked as a carpenter. Raba supported the family by weaving wool and looking after the kids. When the war broke out, the family fled to Jordan. Raba's husband then went to return to Syria to retrieve some documents, but he never came back to Jordan.
My husband was killed when he was drinking tea at my nephew's. A missile hit the house.
That was 5 years ago. Raba's youngest daughters, Fatima and Basma, can't even remember their father. Their older sister, Doa, was 10 when their father died.
I don't want to return to Syria. One reason is that my father is no longer alive. And two, you can't really live in Syria.
Their family home in Homs no longer exists, and Raba's relatives have also moved elsewhere due to the fighting.
I have brothers who are now living in Lebanon, a sister in Germany, and other sisters who moved from Homs to Hama. My parents are living in Turkey.
Raba has managed to build a home for her and her children in Jordan. Her youngest children are going to school here. Her oldest daughter is married, and Raba says she can feel safe in Amman. Just like Huda, who's also from Homs. Her neighborhood in Syria was almost completely destroyed. The 58-year-old now shares a small apartment with her husband and youngest daughter in Amman's east. When she talks about Syria, her face is full of despair.
We can't return to Syria because our house has been destroyed. We don't have a home anymore. My husband is sick and he can't work to pay the rent. We're also scared because it's not safe in Syria anymore.
She doesn't really expect to be able to see her home country again. Her husband had a slipped disc, and she herself needs a pacemaker. They are in debt due to costly medical bills. Returning to Syria is unthinkable, they say. They wouldn't even have money to rebuild their house.
If I think about Syria, memories come flooding back, and often I start to cry.
Sam Baker with a report by Anna Almeling. For our last report, we go to Somaliland, a region in the Horn of Africa that broke away from Somalia decades ago, but hasn't been recognized as an independent state. Recently, many people who tried to find greener pastures in Europe are returning to Somaliland. They are now trying to realize their dreams back home. Neil King has this report by Antje Diekans.
Nuruddin Abdullahi loads up a truck with big packages. It's hard physical work. The 35-year-old is a warehouse worker in Hargeisa, the capital of Somaliland. It's not a dream job, but for Abdullahi it's better than anything he lived through in Switzerland.
When I arrived in Switzerland, it was completely different than I had imagined. I was just a refugee, nothing else. That wasn't my goal.
He is one of many recent returnees to Somaliland, a region in northern Somalia that sees itself as an independent state. It isn't recognized internationally, but it has a separate government. Most important, however, everything is much safer and quieter here than in Somalia. Nevertheless, Abdullahi fled the area a few years ago with the hope of better supporting his wife and five children with work in Europe.
At first I felt welcome. When we crossed over the Mediterranean, our boat went down and people pulled us out of the water. But a short time later, I was just another refugee under the control of others. I was treated like a little child. My life was constantly on hold, and I had to do what I was told. I couldn't live like that anymore. That's why I gave up and came back.
Abdullahi's wife, Noura Omar, is glad to have him back home. They now have a sixth child, nicknamed Better Than Europe. While her husband was fleeing to Europe, Omar was constantly worried.
I was afraid. Terrible things happen on the way to Europe, and he too had bad experiences. I was constantly wondering what I would do if he was tortured or if he didn't come back. I was always thinking about it.
At the Hargeisa airport, about 40 young men disembark from an airplane. Some raise their arms above their heads in victory. They walk single file across the runway and gather in the arrivals hall. They too are returnees, though they didn't make it any further than Libya. It was there that their dream of a wonderful new world shattered, says 23-year-old Abdirizak Saeed. He looks thin and haggard.
I was in Libya for 2 years. Things happened there that violated our human dignity. I was caught like a goat and then sold to a man who resold me to someone else. That's when I understood where my real home was. I said to myself, you lost 2 years, don't waste any more time. Come back now that you have the chance.
The United Nations Refugee Agency and other organizations are working together to bring refugees like him back home. The European Union is offering its financial support. In Libya, refugees have been crammed into so-called detention centers. Many have been abused or raped. Abdirizak Saeed no longer knows why he even left Somaliland in the first place.
Honestly, there was no real reason. I just told myself that I could build a better future in Europe.
The chairman of the National Refugee Authority is also at the airport. The organization was set up to help people return home. It's been a busy year for him.
They are not just coming back from Libya. They are also returning from Europe, Sudan and Yemen. All have come back voluntarily. Though there were also some who told us their repatriation was forced, and in those cases, we stopped the process.
According to Ahmed, significantly fewer young people have been leaving Somaliland. The exodus has fallen over the last 2 years by 70%. At the same time, the number of returnees has increased, and they're very important for Somaliland.
Those who have returned are building the country back up. They're investing, and many are bringing new skills with them. They are opening shops, entering the construction industry, or coming up with other business ideas. Their knowledge is driving Somaliland forward.
Ahmed is talking about returnees like Ifra Abdi. She lived in the US for many years. Her parents fled with her when she was a child, when Somaliland was in the grip of heavy fighting. Abdi grew up there. She even had a green card and was able to work legally. She wanted to open her own cafe, but couldn't fulfill her dream in the US. But it was possible in Hargeisa.
To realize my dream here feels so good. It wasn't easy. It takes time because the country's still recovering, and it takes patience. So far, there's hardly any infrastructure. But there are many of us here who have pushed to make it happen.
Her homemade tarts, croissants, and waffles are popular. Business is so good that Abdi now has 4 employees, 2 bakers and 2 waitresses. She trained them herself. She hasn't regretted her decision to come back to Somaliland for 1 second.
I'm back in my own country and I'm even creating jobs. It's paid off 100%.
Neil King there with a report by Antje Diekans. And that's our show for this week. For more World in Progress episodes, go to dw.com/worldinprogress. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Eliane Gigliarducci, Jürgen Kuhn, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.